The presidential motorcade has just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
Welcome to the show. I'm Adrian Slade. Can we just say something that I know we've all said for years, but let's just scream it from the rooftops. Both sides of the political aisle are completely exhausting, completely draining. I mean, every day you wake up to a news story that has something to do with a fake narrative because we're going to spend all this time trying to destroy the commander-in-chief because he doesn't fit with your political ideology. And then we're going to sit there on the other side and try to debunk it all while we turn around and give little nuggets that lend itself to fortifying the fake narrative. I mean, it's a circus. And then there's us, the principled constitutionalists, the conservatarians that are stuck in the middle, that are partyless because our party just uses us for its primaries and its votes, does nothing with the platform once they get into power. The other party just hates us completely. We're worse than ISIS. And so the other day, I'm out with my wife and my family. You know, it's her birthday and we're out celebrating. And a story comes through, pops up on my phone, and I decide to share it. And of course, you know, both sides of the aisle are jumping on me about it when all I did was just share breaking news. But it's about the Washington Post story about how Trump revealed this ultra-classified information on the ISIS-related plots to the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador, giving out the methods of the plots and the key locations of allies that provided us with that information. And it was all off the cuff, you know. Trump sitting there going, "I get very good intelligence. In fact, I get the best intelligence." Yeah. Not like we couldn't see him saying that, out there touting his impeccable intelligence, his tremendous intelligence. But also never mind the fact that as chief executive, he has the ability to declassify any intelligence that he wants. And it's even stated in the Washington Post story, although it's really far down in the story because they're hoping you don't read that far. They're hoping you're too busy with life that you're just going to take the headline and go, "Well, there you have it." So that doesn't bode well for the Russian narrative, for him to go out and put out tweets like he just did the other morning, actually, where he said, "As president, I want to share with Russia," and an openly scheduled White House meeting, which I have absolute right to do. Facts pertaining to terrorism and airline flight safety, humanitarian reasons, plus I want Russia to greatly step up their fight against ISIS and terrorism. Well, when it comes to Syria, we have two different views. Russia loves Bashar al-Assad. Russia wants the oil resources and a naval port. We, on the other hand, don't like Bashar al-Assad. So, taking on ISIS, yeah, we both want ISIS out, but we're both doing it for the other reasons, so how we go about taking them out is very key. But, you know, of course, Trump is going to add fuel to the Russian narrative every time it can be debunked. Every time there's an opportunity to put an end to it, he goes out there and debunks it. And then the stories come out, of course, like this one, and the left goes crazy, the protest left. Someone took the opportunity to project the emoluments clause over the entrance of Trump International in D.C. You know, the clause is found in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 of the Constitution and reads, "No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state." And the Heritage Foundation clarifies this in excellent fashion. In fact, you can read this entire story on conservativelibrary.com. The prohibition of federal titles of nobility, reinforced by the corresponding prohibition on states' titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 10, and more generally by the Republican Guarantee Clause in Article 4, Section 4, was designed to underpin the Republican character of the American government. In the ample sense James Madison gave the term in Federalist Number 39 in the Federalist Papers, a republic was, quote, a government which derives all of its powers directly or indirectly from the great body of the people and is administered by persons holding their offices during good behavior. Republicanism, so understood, was the ground of the constitutional edifice. The prohibition on titles of nobility buttressed the structure by precluding the possibility of an aristocracy, whether hereditary or personal, whose members would inevitably assert a right to occupy the leading positions in a state. Now, we can go on and complain about foreign influence in money in domestic politics, if you like, on Donald Trump, but we can also do it across the board. Let's not forget something that's seemingly glossed over with this latest stunt. Foreign influence of money in politics isn't confined specifically to the Tangelo savior-in-chief. There's a wider scope than that. And I'll tell you, someone who profited off money from foreign governments at the expense of national security deserves this very greatly. That being the Clinton Foundation. I mean, what about creative nuclear uranium deals that Hillary allowed, which benefited the Russians and profited the Clinton Foundation, ultimately profiting the Clinton family? The crime family. How about the sale of the military jets to Saudi Arabia to use in Yemen, to which they profited off of as well? We can go down a number of items that the Emoluments Clause can be applied to, but it doesn't help that Trump props up the narratives by throwing out little nuggets here and there, reinforcing them with his actions. I mean, take the Trump taxes. Case in point here. Trump says that he's under audit and he won't release his tax returns. Well, it's really not his duty to release tax returns. This is one of those crazy traditions that has begun in politics and somehow has taken root. You know, much like the colors of the parties. You know, have you ever wondered why there's colors of the parties? Well, they were determined by the mainstream media, some going back to the Bush-Al Gore election, but even a little bit prior to that, did they come up with these colors? And of course, how are the colors defined? Well, who defines the parameters? And who sets the rules of the game? Your aggressor sets the rules of the game. If you're the enemy, the aggressor is going to define you. And conservatives, of course, we were busy living our life, not worrying about others, taking care of our family and friends and our community, and worried about ourselves, not in a selfish way, but just worried about the day-to-day. And the rules were set, and we are now constantly on defense. So what do? They pick the colors of the GOP as red. Oh, what, like the communist red? And the Democrats get this nice blue. But they do this with international politics, too. I mean, they dub most socialist nationalist affiliations or parties as conservatives. Look at the Le Pen party. It's a conservative move. No, it's not conservative. But they do that because they want to equivocate the conservative nature of these nationalist socialist movements with the Republican Party because they want us to be seen as some sort of intolerant group that wants to take all your freedoms away, even though we are for the most freedom and limited government. So all these methods are soft branding. These are definitions of your enemy. So the idea that the tax returns should be released by every president is that similar concept. But never mind the fact that Trump released financial statements to show how his business operates. Anyone in accounting understands that financial statements, income statements, balance sheets, statements of cash flows are more definitive and more precise than tax returns. These are the documents investors would look to as a measure of a business's health. But then Trump finds a way to torpedo that argument by fueling the narrative. Trump lawyers say he had no Russian income or debt, with some exceptions. In the New York Times, President Trump's lawyers say that income tax returns do not show income from Russian sources or debt owed to Russians, with the exception of $95 million paid by a Russian billionaire for a Trump-owned estate in Florida and $12.2 million in payments in connection with the holding of the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in 2013. In addition to the Florida estate and the beauty pageant, The lawyers said Mr. Trump had received undisclosed payments over 10 years from Russians for hotel rooms, rounds of golf, or Trump-licensed products like wine, ties, mattresses. But they said those same amounts were immaterial and would not have been identified as coming from Russian sources on the tax return. Realize immaterial in the accounting sense means that it's very minuscule in relation to the total level of income that was received. So, I mean, maybe $95 million in relation to the level of income that Trump is bringing in may seem immaterial to him, but, you know, it also doesn't derive where that income comes from. So, being that it's considered immaterial, it would be allowable to not have that determination. So, it's things like this. Trump firing Comey at the height of the Russian investigation. Keep in mind, we're having an investigation with absolutely no crime. What we're running into is that everyone wanted Comey out. I mean, from my understanding, it was not protocol for an FBI investigation to not only lead open press conferences, but also that he could say that Hillary Clinton was cleared of all charges. He doesn't get to make that determination. But this is nothing new for James Comey. Think of Bill Clinton's grant of clemency for four swindlers as political payback when he was president, which was arranged by Hillary Clinton, as reported by the AP decades ago. The four individuals were convicted of bilking the government out of tens of millions of dollars back when Hillary was the senator of New York. These four lived in a Hasidic Jewish village outside of New York City that actually overwhelmingly voted for Hillary. Imagine that. And James Comey said his office ended its investigations with no charges. He gave no reason. Comey's brother was also a tax attorney for the Clinton Foundation. So, you know, that doesn't stop Trump from dumping fuel on the fire. So he meets with Russian foreign ministers and ambassadors and has this meeting where he says, I'm not going to let the press come in. But yet the Russian press shows up and takes photos. So it looks bad. But of course, the Trumpsters all say, oh, he's playing a genius game of 4D chess, you cuck. You cuckservative? No, he's not. He's laying conservatism on a newspaper and defecating all over it. Is he a Russian agent? No, I don't think so. Even though his former campaign advisor, Paul Manafort, has registered as being a foreign agent after being a campaign manager for the Prime Minister of Ukraine. But I don't believe that Russia, as I've said, go back and listen to the show we did on Susan Rice and the NSA spying and Donald Trump's Russian connections. I believe that there was a little thread of Russian connection, but not politically. I think just through a business-related sense, as we've learned in this article. But at the same time, the DNC built an entire narrative all on top of those little foundation particles to build up the Russian collusion into the actual hacking that occurred, the leaks, the WikiLeaks, the Podesta emails. And we're going to get down to where those actually came from here in just a second. Back in a moment.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
Now, the DNC is painting this picture of Russian collusion by Donald Trump. Go back and listen to the show we did with Susan Rice when she came out and laid it all out on the line, unmasking people. And we can tell you that there is a Russian connection between Trump's business and Russian oligarchs, you know, investing in his business. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing illegal with that. But those are the building blocks that the Democrat Party used as the foundation to build this narrative because Hillary Clinton lost. And like we showed, it doesn't indicate that he was compromised. In fact, we've shown that the spying and the leaks most likely came from within the DNC itself, through the NSA spying, possibly from the rift that exists between the Obama wing of the DNC and the Clinton wing, the same rift that led to the ousting of Hillary Clinton's 2008 run in favor of Obama. And it's becoming clear that this has more to do with the outrage of the Bernie Sanders supporters not being given their fair shake in the primaries. But that leaves the failings of the other side, the DNC, with their base, based on these WikiLeaks emails. I mean, the lawsuit that has been levied against the DNC by Bernie Sanders supporters is really kind of amazing, and it's not really focused on by much of the conservative media. But they're livid about how he was edged out of the primaries. In April 2014, In an email, campaign manager Robbie Mook discusses coordinating the schedule of the Democrat primaries to maximize benefit for Hillary Clinton. Quote, "We agreed that if she gets a significant primary challenger, we need to consider changing course and getting New York, New Jersey, and maybe others to move their dates earlier to give her hefty early wins," Mook wrote. Quote, "We may need allies to help in this process, but we're going to look at each state one step at a time, limiting as much as possible the perception of direct intervention by the principals." The email provides further evidence that the Democrat National Committee and the Clinton campaign colluded to rig the primaries for Hillary Clinton. Other emails released by WikiLeaks confirm the debate schedule was coordinated to the Clinton campaign's preference. A recent thread revealed then DNC chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz directed to hold phony meetings with other DNC candidates to provide the Clinton campaign and DNC with plausible deniability that they were coordinating with one another. In stark violation to its own charter, the DNC undermined democracy to ensure Clinton's coronation as the Democratic presidential nominee. It may be the first time in the Democrat Party has nominated a woman to be president, but equally historic is the extent of corruption exercised within the DNC to rig the election for her. After being defeated in 2008 in the Democratic primaries against Barack Obama, Clinton and her allies worked to avoid this repeat. Despite Sanders' surging popularity, he actually had no chance. Not when the DNC had been working with the Clinton campaign as early as 2014 to ensure that her candidacy and no one else would wind up as the presidential nominee for the DNC. And this from Salon. The election of Donald Trump offered the Democrat Party a huge gift. All signs suggest that the DNC is poised to blow this unique moment and potentially guarantee the GOP increasing success over the next 4 years. This is so because the DNC has become immensely tone-deaf to its own internal problems. Much has been made, for instance, of Trump's historically low approval ratings, but less attention has been drawn to the fact that support for the DNC is even worse. The DNC has only 38.8% favorability rating. In January, a Gallup poll indicated that party identification is at record lows. 42% identifying as independents, 29% as Democrats, 26% as Republicans. A recent Washington Post poll showed that the DNC trailed both Trump and the GOP when voters were asked if the party was in touch with their concerns. In fact, only 28% of those polled felt that the party was connected with the issues that mattered to them. Chris Kazilla notes that 52% of self-identified Democrats said their party was in touch with people's concerns, while 44% said it was out of touch. Quote, "Those numbers, particularly among Democrats, were striking. Party leaders in Washington have positioned the party as the voice of the little guy since the earliest days of the Trump presidency. Their side would be one to stand up for the disenfranchised people of the country whose lives Trump neither cared about nor even thought much about." That's to be debated. Democrats are busy avoiding ignoring their own credibility problems. Even Hillary Clinton has refused to take any responsibility for losing the election. It's worth remembering, for instance, that despite all of the cries of Russian interference and hacking, there would have been no story or scandal if there had not been damaging emails to be found in the first place. And who could forget that Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned as her post as chair of the DNC in the wake of damning evidence of her bias against Bernie Sanders? She was later appointed as honorary chair of Clinton's 50-state campaign. Then there's Donna Brazile, that scandal that showed she had advanced shared debate question knowledge with the Clinton camp. I mean, release of emails revealed that among many of the things that Donna Brazile did as a role as Democrat operative in the DNC vice chair prior to assuming the interim DNC chair position was to share potential town hall topics with the Clinton campaign, and yet she still maintained she was fair to all the candidates. So there is a lawsuit that is happening right now because of the fact that the DNC has basically screwed over its voting base, and the Bernie Sanders wing is seriously livid over this. And that is not even touching the recent news that former President Obama has decided to speak at Wall Street for $400,000, a move Sanders called distasteful. So you've got the Bernie Sanders people that want to take the money and the corruption out of politics, even though they want to hand all their, you know, power to government, which is basically corrupt. And then you've got the GOP and the conservative fallout. I've had a lot of people tell me, because, you know, both establishments are clinging to power at all costs, they're going to snipe out their party's pariahs, the Ron Pauls, the Bernie Sanders, the Ted Cruzes. So look at where we are as a country. We have Trump not delivering on the mandates that caused voters to coalesce behind him in the very first place. There's no walls. There's no Obamacare repeal and replace. Like my quick poem that I put out the other day goes, waiting for the swamp to drain, waiting for the lock her up refrain. But thank the Lord I didn't go insane, lose my mind, and just hop on the train. We have a Democrat establishment openly ignoring its constituents while edging out formidable candidates in the favor of those who are deemed to be next in line for the next run. It's their turn. We have a Republican establishment doing the same thing, passing budgets that look like something that the Obama administration would have submitted, or providing flaccid Obamacare update proposals that have no basis in conservatism. So where does that leave you and I, those who just want limited governance to be in action? For those who know me, I was a Cruz supporter, and I'm not a bitter one for losing. Without a single shred of skin in the game that I have now, and outside of my own love of country, I really can be as objective as I want and call strikes and home runs when I see them. And many of my Trumper friends keep saying, well, do you think Cruz would have even been able to withstand the left's attacks? And I say, oh, yeah, we'd be governing right now. Not golfing in Mar-a-Lago in Florida, dealing with fabricated charges of Russian collusion for the last five straight months, not being able to fulfill a cabinet. The Russian stories are moot points in my mind. And yeah, Ted Cruz would have faced tremendous backlash by all sides, even the Republican establishment and rhino Republican media. But me personally, I'm just done with both sides. I'm looking for a new movement. New movement options at this point, and many of those on the left are in a similar position. But the problem we face is in deciding which direction this cauldron of disaffected voters will go, and it's all based on our fundamental views of freedom and the government's role with it. Do you want the government to handle everything, but yet you're going to limit everybody's ability to be corrupted through government regulations who are put by government corrupt leaders? Just saying. Or do you want personal responsibility, limited government interaction, and minimal government overreach? That's going to decide where these two parts of this ousted group, where do they head to? And I know where I'm heading to. And I'll tell you more about it on the other side of the break.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
On the other side of the break, we were just talking about how both party establishments have basically shoved out some of their principled constituents, some of those who are looking just for values and principles that matter to them, which both establishment sides don't seem to care about anymore. And so that leaves a cauldron of people on both sides of the aisle that are ripe for the taking. And where the Libertarian Party failed, where the Green Party has definitely shown its side as to be more in an authoritarian socialist manner, and where the Constitutional Party just hasn't even arrived, what are the options? And, you know, a couple weeks ago, we talked to J.D. Rucker from the Federalist Party, and now we have Pat Nicholas on the line with us. How you doing, Pat?
Hey, I'm doing great, Adrian. Thanks for having me on.
So how are things out in Missouri?
Oh, fantastic. Warm, awesome. Sunny day.
Yeah, we got that out here, too, which is kind of nice. So now, everybody's glomming for a new movement. And I don't want to just say third party, because there's other parties out there, but real movement, a real party. So tell us a little bit about the Federalist Party from your perspective.
Well, from my perspective, and, you know, I know even J.D. refers to us as a third party. And we are a third party by the technical definition of it. But in my mind, we are the first party. If anything, it's the Democrats and the Republicans that are the new kids that were around on the block. You know, they're the new kids on the block. Federalist Party was around long before either of them were. We are, in my mind, more of a resurgency of the first party than we are a third party.
Seeing the Federalist Party reemerge now, it kind of gives a lot of us conservatarians, constitutionalists, just hope that maybe we can actually move in a new direction and kind of start reining back in government.
Yeah, and I don't think it's just the conservatarians and the constitutionalists. I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, on both sides of the political spectrum that, you know, want their individual liberty, want the government out of their bedroom, want the government out of their lives, you know, believe in free market capitalism. Those are things that aren't partisan. They aren't left or right. And, you know, they're starting to wake up. You can see the light bulb going on. You know, it's, wow, we can rein in federal government. Wow, we can bring things back to the state level. Yeah, you know, we can. Not only can we have to.
Well, it's funny, too, because I kind of feel like the counterculture right now is, you know, conservatism. It's basically where, you know, you look at college campuses, they're just inundated with just totalitarianism and authoritarianism in the way of how you're not allowed to speak your mind and have your viewpoints on display, you know, and you look at all of the different areas to where years ago it was always looked at as, oh, those Republicans are just prudish and they just want to keep everything, you know, like buttoned down like it's Ozzie and Harriet, and they wanted to break out into something new. And I kind of feel like that entire paradigm has shifted. The whole coin has flipped, and having a movement that looks towards limited government, freedom, individuality, I mean, that's it right there.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it kind of interesting how something old and archaic, you know, in the minds of many, the Constitution, you know, been around forever, isn't it kind of cool how it's suddenly new, cool, hip, and edgy again?
Yeah, it really is. It's amazing how you can find things in it and you go, wow, that was actually really cool. You know, and that's one of the things I like about social media. When I get into conversations with people, you know, of course you get into, and you're big on Second Amendment, so we can take it there, but you get into these arguments where they're like, well, you know, the founding fathers, they all just thought, you know, technology was just muskets and, you know, what do you want, a tank? You want a nuclear bomb or something? And I'm like, if you want to know what the founding fathers thought about the Second Amendment, read the Federalist Papers. It's right there. They'll tell you their intentions.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's.
And if I've got the money to buy a nuclear bomb, I'm buying one. I might even paint it turquoise and put it in my backyard. I mean, that's freedom.
That is freedom. That is freedom. You know, and the Second Amendment is 27 words long. That's it. And there's not too many multisyllabic words in it either.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult to understand. The federal government has one thing that it is bound to adhere by in the Second Amendment, and that is to not infringe.
Exactly.
You know, but then you boil that down to the states. You know, things that are not delegated as powers to the federal government, those go to the states and they go to the people. So, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't mention, hey, you need a permit. It doesn't say you don't need a permit, you know. So that does go to the states. That's a state decision. There's people out there that, you know, on both sides of the aisle, you've got the anti-gun crowd that is so extreme that, you know, they want to ban Second Amendment rights from people based on a maybe that they might commit a crime at some nebulous point in the future. But honestly, on our side of the aisle, you've also got the people that are going, well, I don't need a permit. The Second Amendment's my permit. No, your permit is your permit.
Yeah.
You know, there are laws that are delegated to the state level.
And I think they always play, at least on the left side, they always play on the emotions, you know, obviously, because that's how they operate. But when you get into the whole argument about, well, you know, if you're on a no-fly list, then you shouldn't be given a gun. You know, that's Obama's thing. And you're like, well, how did you get on the no-fly list? And how do you get off of it? The problem is you weren't in front of a judge. You didn't have your due process. And you're put on a list just because you might be somebody we got to worry about. And getting off that list might take decades. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, the no-fly list is a huge pet peeve of mine. And that's not just Obama. It's Trump, too.
Yeah,
he came out in support of it in the second debate. He was also, he doubled down on that issue a number of times.
And it's just an emotional talking point. It's like, oh, well, you know, your average person looks at it and goes, oh, yeah, if they're a terrorist, government knows what's right. They put them on a list for a reason. They shouldn't have a gun. That isn't how it works.
No, no. If somebody is going to be stripped of their Second Amendment rights, let's charge them with a crime. Let's convict them of that crime and let's incarcerate them. You know, we have this thing called due process in this country. We don't strip people of the rights based on suspicion.
Exactly. Now, I've got to jump into a break. You want to hang around for another segment?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Stick with us. We'll be back with Pat Nicklaus of the Federalist Party on the other side of the break.
This is Adrian Slade.
Adrian Slade Broadcast.
We're back now with Pat Nicklaus from the Federalist Party. Big on Second Amendments. She's got it down. She's going to go a little further on what we were talking about with due process and, you know, the whole no-fly list, how you just shouldn't be stuck on a list and lose your constitutional right just because somebody deemed it, oh, well, you know, you might be an unsavory character. Let's put you on a list.
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's coming at us. We're honestly being attacked from both sides of the aisle on that one. It's not just the Democrats that are doing that. It is the Republicans, too. There's some senators. There's some reps that are making noises that direction. They're testing the waters to see what their constituents, you know, feel about that. And you're right. It's an emotional game. But, you know, we're letting the government chip away at our liberties in the name of a false sense of security. And that's scary. That's not tyranny lurking around the corner. That's tyranny staring us in the face.
Exactly. And you know, it's just like I always say, you know, and it's obvious between what's happened between Obama and Trump. What was good for one is going to be good for the other. Someday, somebody on the other side gets in power. And if the precedent's set, they're going to exploit it.
Right.
So now, another thing that you mentioned, you were big on pro-life. Tell us a little bit more about the views on that.
Well, it's right there in our founding documents. Anybody who believes in our founding documents believes in, you know, the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I don't see how you can be pro-choice.
Yeah, I agree.
We have the and you know, take that one step further. You want to go to the people who call conservative science deniers? Well, you know, anybody who's pro-choice, they're science deniers. I mean, science has proven a long time ago that human DNA mixed with human DNA creates a totally separate human.
Yeah. You can't, you know, sit there and say, oh, well, you know, you identify as a woman this day, so you can use that bathroom even though you're a male. But then turn around and say, well, we're not going to allow you to see your baby in the womb because, you know, that might take away the scientific aspect. That might actually hit home with you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the hypocrisy of it all is, you know, they believe in a woman's right to choose. Well, what about the woman in the womb?
Yeah, exactly. No one ever puts it from that perspective, you know?
Right, right. And you know that they know just by the language that they use. You know, say a gal that promotes herself as being pro-choice gets pregnant and she wants to have the baby. How many times have you heard a pregnant pro-choice woman say that she's with fetus?
Yeah, exactly.
Or that she's going to have a fetus shower.
I remember when they had Beyonce up on stage. I think it was Beyonce, where she was pregnant and that's what they said. They were like, they were just going on and on about it. And you're just sitting there going, wow, you guys obviously recognize it. I guess it's when you've accepted it as a mother that suddenly it's okay to call it one thing over the next. You know, it doesn't become just a clump of cells and turns into a baby just because of, you know, when it's conceived.
Magic.
Yeah, it's yeah. Basically when you decide as a mother, hey, I'm going to go ahead and keep it. So I guess it's a baby now. That's not how
right.
It works.
No, it's they've tried to really manipulate the language on that one, and they've done a poor job on it.
Yeah, I think, well, and that's one of the things I've noticed even beyond that has been an issue for the left, what they've done, and it's shown their hypocrisy on a grand scale, but they've spent so much time framing the argument to their pet agendas that when it spills over into similar agendas that don't work in their favor or they're not down with, suddenly they have no way to explain it.
Right, exactly. You know, a huge hypocrisy is the pro-choice anti-gun individual.
Yeah.
Because how can you be, you know, support a woman's so-called right to choose what she does with her body, but not support her right to choose how she defends that same body?
Exactly. Or even like what happened in Arkansas when you had the people, you know, I think it was even Johnny Depp and all them out there going, oh, we don't want death row, you know, we don't want the death penalty going on. And you're like, okay, so life is okay for somebody who's been in prison for 20 years because they raped and killed somebody who was going home to their family. But if it's a baby who is the epitome of innocence, well, let's just go ahead and take him out.
Yeah, for convenience purposes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you wouldn't want to ruin your career, you know, by having to be a mother or a father. I mean, come on.
Yeah, amazing. That was probably one of the, what was that Obama said about his daughters?
Oh yeah, he wouldn't
remember
want,
that?
Yeah, he said something about, I wouldn't want my daughter to be
punished.
Punished, that's right. I was going to say penalized, but punished for having a child. You're not punished, it's a gift. And I've got two children, so I've seen it. You become a different person when you have that introduced to your life because you've never seen anything like that.
Exactly.
So I don't know where they would think it's a punishment. But then again, when it comes down to what their real motives are, population control, you know, that's control of resources, worried about overcrowding and, you know, whatever the case may be, they somehow justify these insane ideas.
But, you know, we're talking about like the 10%, in my opinion. I'm a hopeless optimist. OK, we're talking about the 10%. Hardcore progressive on the left that we will never reach.
Yeah.
We've also got the 10% hardcore, you know, Republican establishment that we will never reach.
Exactly.
But got the 80% in the middle that we can persuade.
And now, how does the Federalist Party do that?
Oh, wow. You know,
I'm opening up a whole can of worms on that one, but I'm just looking at it going, I really want to take, because it's so ripe for the taking. It's like you've got both sides have just been burned by the establishments on either end. You know, there's a lawsuit going on right now with the Democrat Party over the fact that they circumvented their charter so that they could push Bernie Sanders out of the way. And they actually set the stage for that back in 2014. So Hillary would win. And then you got the other side who basically took Ted Cruz out, as I called the Charles Sumner moment when they took him out on his Vote Your Conscience speech and basically caned him right there in the convention hall verbally. And, you know, it showed that working within the party, the way Reagan did it, doesn't exist anymore. That's not even an option. So what do we do to gain both of these crowds?
Well, I tell you, I'm big on Facebook. I spend a lot of time on Facebook. And, I've got some Democrat, you know, Blue Dog, but Democrat friends that I've been hammering about the Federalist Party, and they're coming around. And what really seems to work, I mean, it's, I don't want to make it sound like I'm sales pitching them because I'm not. I'm talking to them about what's important to them. We have a tendency to preach to the choir and talk about what's important to us. You know, I'll talk all day long about the Second Amendment. I'll talk all day long about pro-life issues. Everybody's favorite topic is themselves.
Yeah.
What we need to do as the Federalist Party is get outside of ourselves and start talking to other people about what's important to them. You know, a prime example is New York just recently passed, and I'm doing air quotes here, free college. Okay. That is something that appeals to Democrats. It's something that was part of Bernie Sanders' platform. And this is federalism in action. The state of New York determined education for their state. Education is all the way a state-level issue. It's not a federal-level issue.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this whole push for Common Core, you know, you look at it and you're going, this should be something that the municipalities and the states handle because they have the resources to meet the need directly. And if you don't like the way education's done in this state, you got 49 others you can go to.
Yeah. So that's how you reach the Democrats, is by talking to them about the issues that are important to them. One thing the Republican Party has failed miserably on is going into enemy territory, or what is perceived to be enemy territory. They don't go into minority neighborhoods and talk to minorities. They don't, they're not very well with women. They won't, you know, try and cross the line and talk to Democrats about what's important to them. All the Republican Party has been reduced to is talking about what's important to the Republican Party. And that I think is why they're losing a huge chunk of their base that's looking for something more. You know, the college issue is huge to Democrats. the, you know, they legalized pot out in Colorado. That's not something I'd want in my state, but, you know, it's a state-level decision.
Exactly.
Marriage, you know, I was flabbergasted by the gay marriage ruling. If anything should be a state-level decision, it's marriage. You know, so there's a lot of ways to reach Democrats if we stop talking about conservative issues to them and start talking to them about issues that are important to them.
I agree. I mean, when you boil it down and say, hey, do you enjoy the opportunity to make choices for yourself without having government on top of you? Do you have the opportunity to, do you want the freedom to forge your own path? You know, I think those things kind of hit home when you boil it down to its essence, which opens the door for the conversation to make the point, hey, this is how you can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I said earlier, a lot of those things aren't partisan issues, you know, freedom, individual liberty, you know, raising your family without government interference, you know, privacy. They're not partisan issues. We just have to take a look at how Democrats want them applied to their lives and say, we can do that. You know, as a party, we can do that. Yes, we're a pro-life party. Don't let that drive you off, Democrats. You know, that's one huge segment of the population that I think we could really reach as the pro-life Democrat.
Pat Nicholas from the Federalist Party, tell us how we can check out more about it.
Yeah, you can go to thefederalistparty.org or text Federalist to 53445. For updates, we're not going to spam you. If you text that, we'll just give you a regular update.
Awesome. Enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week.